for listening to Curious Medicine. This episode is not suitable for children. Hello and welcome back to Curious Medicine. I'm Christy.
And I'm Eric.
And today we're talking about buried alive, but this is really how not to be buried alive.
Yes, exactly.
And I was so pleasantly surprised at how much information there was about this topic.
I can only imagine.
And I cannot wait to have this conversation with you. It's going to be so fun.
I'm excited to have it.
And you know, you and I talked about this briefly on our episode about fumigation when you talked about tobacco smoke enemas and you started sort of naming some of the things, crazy things that they did to make sure people were not alive before they were buried.
That's
right. I said, oh, you know, we should do a whole episode on it. So here we are.
Ta-da.
Yay. Thank you so much for doing this.
I'm happy to be here.
Okay. Eric, do you have any opening stories?
It's not as interesting as the opening story.
Yeah, no, you've been deemed the most interesting opening story.
But I do definitely recall being a child and going to my grandfather's wake.
Yes.
And asking my mom, what is going on? Why are we doing this?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're definitely going to get into that today.
Yeah. Yes. 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 We're going to talk about the concept of awake and how that started. And at least briefly, we're going to touch on that.
Yes.
Has it ever crossed your mind to be buried alive?
You know, I've seen so many movies and shows where the people are buried alive and, mm-hmm. and they just show like the claw marks, not
yeah.
even the claw marks, the fingernail marks.
Yeah.
And I just, oh, no. I haven't thought about it.
Yeah.
But the thought of it is agonizing. Just even now, it's my nails are hurting.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest with you, the thought or the fear of being buried alive has never crossed my mind. I don't think I've ever sat around going, what if? That's never crossed my mind.
Well, that's how terrifying it is.
It terrifies you to even think about it.
Right.
But I was talking to somebody, a friend of mine, and I was telling him that you and I were going to be talking about this topic. And he said, oh, yeah, you know, my son and I have had this conversation, like worst ways to die or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, wow, this has never crossed my mind. But most of this, you know, is from the Victorian era, which is my favorite time in history. And actually, if I could go back in time and live in any other era, this is the era that I would want to have lived in.
Yes, yes.
Even long before I started this podcast, I have always felt this way. I'm an old soul and I feel like maybe, you know, I have some connection to that era. But
I thought I was an old soul by wanting to relive the 50s.
But the Victorians, you know, they were wackadoodles. I mean, they were so whacked out. And also, they were, you know, drugged up mostly, too, because if you listen to the patent medicine episode, we talk a lot about how crazy the drugs were that they took then. Practically everything had like alcohol, cocaine or heroin in it. So,
well, we talk about this often at work or during lunch.
Uh-huh.
And I say the same thing now. We're doing everything we're doing now. And who knows what's going to be said about us in 200 to 300 years.
100%. Yes. Yes. Yeah. All right. Well, so the fear of being buried alive is actually termed taphophobia. So there's actually a word for it.
Taphophobia.
The fear of being buried alive. Mm-hmm. During the 18th and 19th century, there were no medical testing devices such as brain scans or EKGs in which to determine death. So most rational people during this time argued that decay was the most certain sign of death and that no apparently dead person should be buried, cremated, or dissected until putrefaction had begun.
Mm.
So, gross.
Yikes.
Yeah. Determining the death of a person was most often based on if they looked dead. But apparently, as we're going to find out, it can be surprisingly deceiving. And there are many reports of people being erroneously pronounced dead And some were even buried alive.
Dun, dun, dun.
So to, you know, distinguish between being erroneously pronounced dead and being buried alive is that maybe you got pronounced dead and then they took your body, you know, to the church cemetery or, you know, wherever they were going to take, whatever they were doing, they were preparing your body, they were wrapping you in a shroud or whatever they were doing, and then you woke up.
Yep.
But some people actually made it all the way to burial.
Yeah.
And there's various reasons on why they know this, but that was a whole interesting thing too.
Have you heard of you've seen The Office, right?
Yes.
Okay, so in The Office,
uh-huh.
I don't know if we're allowed to talk about The Office, but in The Office.
Yes, we can. I think, yes.
Dwight is one of the main characters there.
Yes, the beet farm owner.
Yes, the beet farm owner. Yes. Exactly. He says in one of the episodes that in his family, it is tradition to shoot someone in the head.
Mm.
Do you remember that?
No, but keep talking.
To make sure that they have actually passed on.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, the Schrutes were no fools then. For those that lived in the Victorian era.
Mm-hmm.
For a variety of reasons, persons who were mistakenly buried alive have been exhumed only to discover post-burial self-inflicted injuries.
Mm.
In fact, some bodies were found turned over or face down. I mean, like, it's crazy.
I mean, just think about it. And it's not like the coffins that we have now. We're talking about, like you said, the Victorian era.
Right. Some people were buried alive and yet lived to tell about it, such as examples where grave robbers were trying to steal a fresh corpse for dissection at medical schools. Okay, now here's a story from a book called The Lazarus Syndrome.
In former times, when surgeons and anatomists found it difficult to obtain human cadavers for research and teaching purposes, they were obliged to enter into a devil's pact with the body snatchers, who willingly supplied them with what they needed for cash. Ugh. One of the top body snatchers was Jack Hall, whose day job as an undertaker gave him useful inside knowledge about where bodies had been freshly buried. While body snatching was a despicable and much hated trade, it nonetheless did result in the release from the grave of some prematurely buried people. Here we go. Although they then often had to face being dissected alive. Oh, wow. The ones that made it through both processes were life's real lottery winners. No, no kidding. Two astonishing cases are worth relating. In 1824, a young medical student named John McIntyre, having worked himself into a state of complete physical and mental exhaustion, was put to bed, suffered a further deterioration that brought him to the brink of death, and developed catalepsy. He was examined by a doctor who found no sign of life and certified him dead. He was laid out, and although he was fully aware of what was going on around him, he was unable to make any sound or movement to alert those who came to weep over him that he was still alive. Oh, how horrifying.
It's like being present at your own funeral.
That's horrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's worse than, that's just like those dreams that you have.
The ones that I told you where I'm driving and I can't wake up.
Yes.
I can't open my eyes.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yes. Oh my goodness. On the morning of the fourth day, the undertakers employed to conduct his funeral and burial forced him roughly into a coffin that was too small for him. Oh, oy vey. He recalled later that when they nailed down the lid, each hammer blow rang through my head like a tocsin. The coffin was conveyed to the local cemetery. A funeral service was said for him, and he was lowered into the grave. Oh, my goodness. He remained conscious throughout the dreadful proceedings, yet he was still powerless to move. He recorded what happened next. Oh, I'm getting chills already.
I know.
Oh, Halloween.
Yeah.
A jolt told me that I had reached the bottom, and faintly, from far above, came the mournful voice of a friend bidding me a most tender adieu. Next moment, and an appalling thunder of sound, like so many bolts descending upon my head, informed me that the grave was being closed. The earth packed hard above me. The light had gone, and I was alone. Oh, what a recollection. Poor John McIntyre could not tell exactly how long he had remained so uncomfortably buried, but it was probably for several hours. He says, I hope that my sufferings would be brief. He comments, the lack of air would swiftly put paid to me, but yet I lingered on. Then, to his surprise, he heard a noise above him. Faint at first, but growing steadily louder, until at last he could distinguish the sound of digging and men's voices. Finally, the loud scrape of shovels against the coffin lid told him that his wooden prison had been uncovered. I'm literally getting chills.
I know.
He felt a surge of relief and hope as the coffin was hauled up and then placed on the ground above. Almost immediately, there followed a deafening sound of crowbars being used vigorously and the splintering of wood. Can you imagine how amazing that sound was to him? The splintering
yeah,
of pray. Wood?
Yes. Yeah.
Suddenly, the lid of the coffin was wrenched open and cool, fresh air flowed in around him. His heart leaped. But he had been exhumed. Unable to move or even open his eyes, John could not see the man who had exhumed him, nor did he understand their unseemly haste and the unfeeling way in which they wrenched him from the coffin. But when they thrust him into a sack and carried him away in it, he realized to his horror that their hard work had not been carried out to save him, but to sell him to the anatomist. Oh my goodness.
I know, you can't make this stuff up.
He had been resurrected by body snatchers.
Mm-hmm.
They carried him for some way and then into a building. He recalls, I was finally taken into what was, from the echoes, a largish sort of room, possibly underground, and laid upon a stone slab, damp and chill, with a cold that penetrated the very bones. All about me, I could hear voices, a veritable cacophony. Hands began prodding at me, fingers poking and pressing upon various of my organs, and then one of my eyelids being pulled back. I was enabled at last to see, and wished almost, indeed, that I had not, for the sight that met my eyes was far more encouraging. I was in a dissecting room, stretched out like a fish upon a marble slab, and surrounded on all sides by numbers of young men, amongst whom I recognized several of my erstwhile colleagues. Amazingly, John McIntyre had been sold to one of his own teachers who intended to carry out an electrical experiment on him before he dissected him. To his alarm, John felt wires being attached to his body, and then, as the current was switched on, a million lights exploded before my eyes, and my body was almost burst asunder with the shock. The second electrical charge involuntarily contracted the muscles of his abdomen and made him sit up. His eyes also flicked wide open. He saw those around jump back in horror at the awful sight. Indeed, his fellow students were so appalled at this treatment that some cried out it was enough. Good for them.
Yeah, but probably only because they knew him.
Right. The professor indeed thought better of repeating the experiment, but by carrying it out, he may have inadvertently saved John, for the electric current doubtless played a part in breaking the hold of his catalepsy. This is what happened next. Once more, I was stretched upon my slab of marble. The professor in charge approached me, knife in hand, made a light incision down the center of my chest. And in that moment, it was as if something inside me suddenly burst free. A shrill cry tore its way out of my throat to be answered by echoing cries from those around me. The ties of death had been broken. I had come back to life. Oh, just imagine. I mean, obviously, the author does really well describing all of this. But to see when they open your eyelids that you cannot open yourself, familiar faces all around you.
Yeah.
And to know exactly what's going on.
Right. Yeah, because you've been in that room. Mm-hmm. You've seen the corpse lay on that slab. Yes. You know, you've been one of the spectators. Yeah. It reminds me of... I don't know if you, well, you were probably too young, but okay, when I was in my late 20s.
Thank you for that. I'm not, but thank you.
When I was in my late, this is a little bit of an aside, but when I was in my late 20s, I had to have foot surgery on both of my feet. Mm-hmm. And so I elected to just do them both at the same time and just be done with it. And I remember Oprah, God love Oprah, but I have played What If so many times in my mind because of Oprah shows that I've seen.
Wow.
Oprah had had people on her show that had been under anesthesia and they were paralyzed, but they were not asleep. Mm-hmm. So they felt the whole surgery. They couldn't respond or they couldn't alert anyone because they were paralyzed.
Right.
So they basically felt everything in these very invasive surgeries, some of these people. And it was so, you know, it was so traumatic for these people. So I just remember, like, I worked at the hospital where I had the surgery. Oh. And so I was like, please, God, you know, don't let me be one of these people.
Yeah.
And, and I remember I was coming out of... Yeah, you know, I guess they were finished with the surgery, but I was starting to wake up.
Right.
And I remember somebody like playing with one of my feet. They were doing something with one of my feet.
Oh,
and
no.
I thought, oh my God. And my thoughts were, oh my God, oh my God, they're fixing to operate on the other foot. And I'm awake, like, oh. But I couldn't, like, I was still too drowsy to talk, but I remember panicking in my mind because I'm like, oh my God, they're going to operate on my other foot and I'm not asleep anymore.
Oh no.
But they were just finished with everything. So
isn't our brain amazing though?
Yeah. It but just I mean, I was, to... yes.
Oh my goodness.
It was so scary. Yeah. So yeah. So I, although I haven't imagined being buried alive, I have imagined being operated on and not being able to alert anyone that, hey, I'm weak.
Have you, well, obviously you've experienced it, but like sleep paralysis with your dream as well. Would you compare your sleep paralysis to that in any way?
I don't know that I have sleep paralysis per se, but I dream some, I have a recurring dream mm-hmm. that I am doing something really important, like driving a car, mm-hmm. like on a windy mountain road in the dark or something, like worst case scenario where you really need to be paying attention.
Yeah.
But in my dream, I'm so tired and drowsy, I cannot open my eyes.
Yeah.
And so I'm basically just driving with my eyes closed.
Oh.
And I'm just waiting to crash because oh. I'm just like, and I'm just trying so hard in my dream to open my eyes and wake up and I just can't.
Imagine if you feel the way you feel during those moments, how
right.
he felt.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Yeah. Mm. And also, I have insomnia. So recently, I started taking melatonin.
Oh.
Which always gave me bad dreams many years ago when I tried melatonin. And I wouldn't take it because they were very scary dreams.
Right.
And I took one Friday night. And I swear I will never take one again.
Oh, no.
I had the worst dreams Friday night. And I slept with my bedroom door open, which I usually don't. And I live alone.
Yeah.
But I was kind of coming to through this melatonin, you know, grogginess. Every time I would have a bad dream and I would think, oh, I should go close my bedroom door because at least if somebody's in here and they're going to get me, I'll at least hear the door open maybe. So like I got myself all freaked out, but I was too tired and groggy from this stupid melatonin to do anything to close the door and feel safer. It was just horrible. So I'm like, I am not taking melatonin again. It just always makes me have terrible dreams.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's horrifying.
I know. That's the bad thing about living alone. It's like there's nobody to cuddle up to and go, I had a bad dream.
I'll bring Finley over.
Yeah. Finley is his dog.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, that was a great story. So we have many more to go. Besides being buried alive, there are stories of being cremated while alive and also being dissected while alive.
I'm realizing I'm making faces over here.
It's okay. It's all right. Nobody can see you but me. Such as was the case in 1964 New York. Okay. This is another story that you cannot make up. Okay. As a pathologist was making the first incision at autopsy, the quote unquote corpse suddenly leaped up and seized the poor man by the throat. The corpse lived, but the pathologist suffered a cardiac arrest and died on the spot.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, this is in 1964.
That's horrifying.
That's not that long ago.
That is. Yeah, you're right. I didn't. Yeah.
That's right. That's not too far before I was born.
How bad is it that I want to say that was only 20 years ago?
Well, it was a little bit more than 20.
It was more than 20 years ago.
It's okay. Yeah. We're not math people. All right. It's important to define and distinguish apparent death from actual death, because we're going to be, for one thing, we're going to be using the term apparent death a lot throughout this episode. Okay. Mm-hmm. So apparent death is a period of time when many signs of death are evident, but in the event that certain techniques were applied, the person could still be resuscitated. Mm-hmm. So, you know, again, we can't make this stuff up. Here's a cautionary tale of the importance of distinguishing between the two. And I didn't really know where else to fit this into the episode, so we're going to read this story now, again, from the Lazarus Syndrome. So, Eric, take it away.
A more recent case of the rape of a supposed corpse is reported, among others, by Dr. Michael Ryan in his Manual Medical book. The date of the occurrence is uncertain, but it probably happened in the 16th century. A youthful monk who was on a journey stayed the night at a house where a pretty young woman had just died and was laid out for burial. Mm. He offered to mount a vigil by the bed and say prayers for her, but when they were left alone, he could not resist the temptation of stripping the girl and admiring her feminine loveliness.
And he was a monk.
Wow. Then, becoming excited by what he saw, he took the opportunity of satisfying his lust on her unresting body. The next day, he continued his journey, and a few hours afterwards, much to everyone's astonishment, the girl spontaneously came back to life. She knew nothing of the sexual assault on her, although it eventually became clear that something odd had happened. For, in due course, she found out that she was pregnant, and 9 months after the monk's visit, she gave birth to his child. On his return journey, the monk stopped at the same house, where he learned that his nefarious act had made him a father. Instead of slinking off, however, he owned up to the vile deed, offered to marry the young mother, and, on gaining release from his religious vows, kept his promise. The pair, it seems, not only lived happily together, but produced more children. So necrophilia can end happily for all concerned. I am shaking my head. I cannot. Yeah. I cannot believe that.
I know.
Ay vey.
I know. Mm-mm. And these aren't fairy tales. These are supposed, you know, actual documented, like, medical cases. So, right. Yeah, it's unfathomable to me.
I want to appreciate the fact that he owned up to it. I really do.
Well, okay, let's pick that apart a little bit.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Go ahead. So,
he did what he did, and then he came back and... is Christian enough of a man to say, you know what, I'm going to fess up and be honest. And I did this.
I mean, he did think she was dead. So, I mean, I don't know if that works for him or against him in my book, because he was a monk. Right. So he was supposed to be celibate, I presume.
Right.
And he's like, well, I mean, who's going to know except me and God, because she's dead. Mm. So I'm not hurting anybody. Mm. But also gross.
I know. And then she got with him.
Gross. Like, right. What must she have been thinking the rest of her days?
Do you think she was forced to?
I hope nobody else dies around here.
We have to
I'm going to have to see where you are.
Right. But we also have to remember what day and age this was in. So she probably didn't have much say in it.
Right. Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Mm. And then also like he had the nerve to go back to stay at that house, like on his way back home Okay. Mm. The only story that I know about a necrophiliac, this is so disgusting. My very first job out of college, I worked at a hospital where the little temporary morgue or whatever was right next to where we punched in the hall.
Oh, wow.
By our department. So there was like this little refrigerated room, you know, and it had like space for like three bodies. And I remember like one time I was clocking in and somebody was going in there, and me and my best friend from college, we worked together. And so we were, you know, we were like young 20 year olds, whatever. And we were like, oh, we want to see what's in there, you know, because we knew that that's where the dead bodies were. And so the guy that was like opening the door, he was like, oh, you want to come in and look? And so we just stuck our head in. And I just remember it was like this narrow room, and it just, you know, I don't remember being too impressed, but I just remember thinking, oh, how creepy.
Yeah.
And then fast forward a few years, there was a guy that worked the night shift, and I thought he worked for the lab, but I don't know what department he worked in. Anyway, long story short, you know, I used to see him very frequently because I was like the very early morning person. So I would get there first, and I would see him on most days, and we would just pass him hall and, you know, exchange niceties or whatever. Cause again, he was kind of working in the same area where, you know, our time clock was.
Right.
He, all of a sudden, I quit seeing him, and he was accused of having sex with a corpse. Oh. And so got fired.
And you used to say hello to him.
Yeah, I know.
Oh my gosh.
Mm. Anyway,
I
hadn't thought about that guy.
Yeah.
Until yesterday
when
I was organizing my notes.
Oh no.
I was like, ooh, and I read that story. I was like, ooh.
Yeah.
I think I know a necrophiliac. I mean, I don't think it was a rumor, but I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Anyway. Okay. Accounts, maybe not of being buried alive, but of at least being mispronounced dead, go all the way back to the first century. And are well documented in medical texts, academic books, newspaper articles, and art. Can't forget about our art.
Right. Mm-hmm.
There are so many accounts, in fact, that we could have a whole podcast, not just an episode, but a whole podcast on these stories if we wanted to. This seemed especially prevalent in Western Europe and England during the 19th century. But there are also accounts as recent as 2014.
2014.
Wow. Eric, take it away. Tell us a story again from the Lazarus syndrome.
Wow, really? 2014?
Yeah. Jeez. Yeah, yeah. There's probably more recent ones than that, but this book is kind of old. This one may not be the one from 2014, but...
Michel Delapine certainly had cause for complaint in this regard when he mysteriously collapsed at his home in Door, South Belgium, on Wednesday, the 16th of March, 1988. The doctor, who was called by his alarmed father, Alfred, examined Michelle, but quickly concluded that nothing could be done for the 33-year-old, as he was dead. He accordingly issued a death certificate. Yet, astonishingly, several hours later, when Michelle was at the funeral home, the undertaker halted his preparations to bury him because he thought his corpse was too supple to be dead. Supple.
That's not what you would think of when you think of supple.
Yeah, I'm alive. I'm supple.
Yeah, my corpse is supple.
The worried man contacted another doctor for a second opinion, but he confirmed the verdict of his colleague. Hence, Michel Delapine, according to two doctors, was as dead as a doornail.
Supple. A supple doornail.
However, the undertaker, who had seen many more corpses than they had, and who knew that Michel Delapine should be showing signs of rigor mortis if he was really dead, was still unconvinced. So he telephoned for an ambulance and had Michel taken to a local hospital. There, he was given emergency resuscitation treatment and, to his grieving family's delight and relief, eventually recovered consciousness. On waking, the first words Michelle said were, I'm cold. He is now fully recovered and glad to be alive, especially as he knows how close he came to being prematurely interred.
Mm-hmm.
Two physicians declared him
dead. Yeah, I know. And that's in 1988. And folks, we have way more sophisticated medical equipment now.
Thank goodness for the undertaker.
Yes.
I mean, how are you a physician and not taking into account, okay, how long has this body been quote unquote dead?
things are not like we see on TV with CSI. I'll just tell you that.
I see that.
All right. This issue of people being so scared to death of, like, that there's an irony. Scared to death of being buried alive. That's probably, that's a little bit catchy. I am scared to death of being buried alive.
There you go.
It was so prevalent that they created the London Association for the Prevention of Premature Burial. This was co-founded in 1896. In the 1800s, it was not common nor mandatory for a physician to examine a body after death and declare the person deceased. The absence of a final check by a competent person for signs of life led to fears of premature burial, and rightfully so, I would say, mm-hmm. after all we've heard so far, and we've just scratched the surface. Co-founder William Tebb wrote a book called Premature Burial and How It May Be Prevented. His book gave accounts of 219 cases of near live burials, meaning that people were pronounced dead and then suddenly woke up. Wow. Of these 219, 149 cases of actual live burial, 10 cases of live dissection, and 2 cases while being embalmed.
Oh, no.
I know.
Oh.
Okay. How often does this happen? At the end of the 20th century, estimates were as high as 2%. Okay, 2%. That's like 2 out of 100, yeah. if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. I mean, I'm not a math expert, but I mean, that is high.
That is 2% of a whole populace.
Yeah. And then during wars and epidemics, estimates were as high as 4%. Mm. And we are currently living in a pandemic. So, okay. With a shortage of respirators at one point. So I'm just saying. Yes. I'm just saying.
Yes. Yes. We surpassed 700,000.
Those mass graves in New York, you know, it's just so sad to imagine. Ugh. Okay. There are certain medical conditions that may mimic death and could be contributing factors to a live burial. Cataplexy is one of them. It's a sudden and transient episode of muscle weakness accompanied by full conscious awareness, typically triggered by emotions such as laughing, crying, or terror.
I wonder why.
I mean, I laugh a lot and I hope I never become cataplexic. Cataplexy affects approximately 70% of people who have narcolepsy.
Oh, wow.
And I thought of the guy that fell asleep on our date. Oh. maybe he was overcome with such emotion. Like, maybe he felt, you know, terrified of me.
No, it was not that. It was
anyway.
Not that.
I did think about that. The term cataplexy was first used around 1880 in German physiology literature to describe the phenomenon of tonic immobility, also known as playing possum, in reference to the opossum's behavior of feigning death when threatened.
They do that.
I know. Okay, another medical condition is catalepsy, which is something that you've already discussed. That is a nervous this one really fascinates me. Mm-hmm. I mean, because this dude was a medical student, he was in this coffin, you know, he was completely aware of everything that was going on and yet unable to do anything about it. It is crazy to me. Okay. It is a nervous condition characterized by muscular rigidity and fixity of posture, regardless of external stimuli, as well as decreased sensitivity to pain. Symptoms include a rigid body, rigid limbs. This is the one that's the most crazy to me.
Yeah.
Limbs staying in the same position when moved. The difference between this and rigor mortis is that with rigor, if an arm is raised, it will fall back down when you let it go.
Oh.
But with this, if you, and if you Google search this and you look at these old, you know, black and white Victorian era photos, it'll have like this woman in this like little house on the prairie dress with a crazy bun in her hair. And she's like standing out with her arm stretched out, you know, like, yeah. I mean, it is so creepy. So, yeah. Oh, that's what I could go for Halloween. There I could be go. A cataleptic person. So
switch up the poses.
Yeah. No response, loss of muscle control, and slowing down of bodily functions such as breathing, and no protective reflexes of the pupils and or eyelids.
That's exactly what we just
Yeah, read. It's crazy. It's like, instead of like having mind over matter, this is matter over mind. Mm-hmm. It is so crazy to me. It's so crazy to me that your body is capable. The body is the most fascinating, crazy thing.
And for it to all just go away suddenly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, with a couple of electric shocks. Galvanism. Okay. Asphyxia cholera. That's another one. So living comatose persons take on a corpse-like coldness. This was especially prevalent during the cholera epidemic. Mm-hmm. Other crises that could present as apparent sudden death would be things like heart attack or heart failure, epilepsy, acute stress, electric shock, aneurysm, fright, intense excitement. And here again, I'm talking about my second date with a guy that fell asleep on it.
It was definitely the
because I was so exciting. Yes, I was intensely exciting, and it just put him right to sleep. He got a good little nap. Drowning, strangulation, hanging, asphyxiation, heat stroke, diabetic coma, low blood pressure, and or head injury. All right. Now, in order to make sure that a person was really dead, they had what they called death tests. So I am going to read a list of things that they would do to test to see if you were dead. Now, they might not do, of course, they didn't do all of these things to the same corpse, but right. They would, you know, maybe do one of these things or maybe more than one of these things. Okay, so here's just a random list. There, it's in no specific order. Placing a fine down feather on the mouth or nostrils to see if it moved.
That I like.
That seems, that's probably the most, that's probably the nicest thing you're going to see on this list. I'll tell you that.
I'm glad it's at the top.
Yeah, it's just pure coincidence, by the way. Okay. Holding a mirror over the mouth or nostrils to see if it fogged up. And, you know, when I was reading this stuff and I was researching this stuff, they go into such detail about, well, you know, this might not work because, you know, if the body temperature is blah, 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 and the, you know, the ambient temperature is blah, 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 you know, it won't produce the moisturizing effect on the mirror, blah, blah. Yeah. And so it got just so technical, you know. So well, there's caveats. Like the yeah. So there's caveats to all of these things, right? Okay. This one's one of my favorites. Yelling a person's name loudly 3 times. If no response, the person was considered dead. I mean,
not once or twice, right. But 3 times.
Yeah. I mean, you have a cataleptic person and you yell their name 3 times and they're probably inside their head screaming, yes, yes, I'm here. It's me. Okay. How about this? Inserting various irritants into the nostrils, such as sternutatories. Things that induce sneezing. Arines, things that induce increased mucus secretions and or sneezing. Mm. Salts, stimulating liquors. Horseradish in your nostrils.
Yeah.
And the point of a pencil. I mean, that just seems mean. Well, I guess, you know, I guess it's mean to bury you alive too.
Right.
What's meaner?
So I guess they would just put the pencil inside the nose to...
I guess just like, because, you know, inside your nostril is so sensitive.
Right.
So, I mean, get a pencil, stick it up your nose. a cup of water on the chest test. Okay. This was interesting. Mm-hmm. This happened in the around the year 1700. Some dude came up with this. Okay. This is another quote from the Lazarus Syndrome book. Mm-hmm. In former times, it was recommended that the doctor's senses should always be aided where possible. Thus, in order to detect slight movements of the chest, it was suggested not only that it should be bared, but that a watch glass filled with water should be stood on the xiphoid cartilage, which lies at the lower end of the sternum. Mm-hmm. A movement of trembling of the water in the glass, no matter how slight, reveals respiratory movements within the chest. However, a lack of movement in the water cannot be taken as an irrefutable sign of death. So you could maybe prove that someone's alive, but you can't really prove that they're dead.
Mm. Yeah.
Anyway, seems problematic, but you know, nonetheless, they were giving it the old college try. They were at least doing something,
right,
besides screaming your name three times. Moving on. Burn the skin with a candle flame or other intense heat source. The concept here is that dead skin will char and living skin will form a blister.
Oh.
So that seems pretty, you know, except again, where they get very technical, you know, there, if when I was researching this stuff, they were saying there are stages of death and, you know, right, the muscle lives longer,
yes,
than certain other cells in the body. And anyway, it can, so you know,
this test only work. It works if you're lucky enough to be burned at the right point in time.
Exactly. Or, yeah. Yeah. It probably if you're decomposing, but you have to make sure that's not gangrene. Okay. Stimulate the skin with liberal application of whips and nettles, which nettles are needles. So, okay. Irritation of the intestines with acrid enemas. Shock the ears by hideous shrieks and excessive noises.
Imagine just being that person with catalepsy, just going through all of
this. I know. Well, I'm just imagining this shock the ears by hideous shrieks and excessive noises. Anyone who knows me knows that I have misophonia. It's self-diagnosed misophonia, which means that certain noises irritate the fuck out of me. And this would be, you know what? Just bury me.
Right.
just bury me, because I cannot hear these noises. That's how I would be, if, depending on what the noise is.
Oh my goodness.
Okay. Apply itching powder to the skin. Chopping off a finger or a toe. Oh. Pour scalding hot water on the corpse. Agitate the limbs through violent pulling. I mean, can you imagine what a circus this would be? You know, you have these guys all around the, you know, table, and they're just pulling and pouring and poking and whatever. Okay, here are a few of my personal favorites. A quote from another book called Buried Alive. Vinegar and pepper should be poured into the corpse's mouth, and where they cannot be had, it is customary to pour warm urine into it, which has been observed to produce happy effects. Happy effects, I hope what they mean is that the person wakes up. That's what I hope.
Yeah.
And maybe some of this does actually work, since there is a report from the early 18th century when a nobleman, just before burial, awoke in his coffin after his physician blew pepper into his nostrils.
That's an arine.
Yeah. Yeah. Cut the feet with razors. You know, what if you're still alive? Then you're going to have these. Oh, God, that'd be so painful. Okay, here's one that you already knew about, Eric. Mm-hmm. Long needles under the toenails. Because you talked about that on our fumigation.
Yes.
Several bodies have been exhumed from the 18th century with bronze pins inside the coffin near the feet, thus proving that they really did actually do these things.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Red hot iron applied to the soles of the feet. Pour boiling Spanish wax on the corpse's forehead. On the forehead? Mm-mm. I mean, why? I mean, the forehead? Ugh. Okay. Okay, places. Here's one. Yeah. Here's one for you. This will make you squirm. Red hot poker up the rectum.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay. If I have not responded to a red hot poker up the rectum, just go ahead and bury me. If I haven't responded to those horrible sounds and a red hot poker up the rectum, don't do anything else to me.
It makes sense. It makes perfect sense to think, oh, we're going to do all of this to make sure. But
Monteverdi's test. This is an injection of ammonia subcutaneously. Apparently, it creates a characteristic red flush if the skin cells are still alive. But there's no change in color if skin cells are dead.
This one's a little more civil.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah, I'll take that ammonia test.
Yeah, yeah, let's do that.
Please. Mm-hmm. Holding a candle under a person's finger to look for blood. Okay, the 18th century doctors and barber surgeons didn't yet fully understand circulation, but they did know enough to know that circulating blood was required for life to exist. So pulse checks weren't yet standardized or widespread. The heat of the flame might do one of two things. It might either cause a response due to the pain from the heat, or it may visibly show the onlooker if the blood is circulating or pooling. I don't really know. In a truly dead person, blood pools in extremities and dependent areas, mm-hmm. and the fingertips become darker. But I hope they don't have Raynaud's syndrome, because I have Raynaud's syndrome. And sometimes the tips of my fingers or my whole hand or my toes, my entire foot might turn absolutely purple. It goes in this weird, especially in the winter, this happens. My son does the same thing, yeah. except his whole leg is affected usually.
Yeah.
But my hands or my feet will turn completely white, like I'm dead. Like there will be no, it will just be completely white. Then it'll turn purple. Then it'll turn bright red when the blood rushes back in. It's crazy. And I'm just sitting there watching it happen. And it's so weird. It's so weird.
Yeah.
So hope they didn't have that. All right. Smelling salts. Most contain ammonia, which irritate the mucous membranes when inhaled, triggering rapid inhalation. Smelling salts are used to arouse after fainting. Used alone, these would not be effective to determine death in a person with severe head injury or who's in a coma. These were widely available in the Victorian era when women wore tight corsets and even had special couches upon which to faint when they were waiting for their pelvic massage. Also included in the first aid kits in World War II. Mm-hmm. And we used to have these in every room taped to the wall in the first hospital I ever worked at.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Next thing is a thanatometer. It's a long thermometer invented in 1841. It's inserted into the stomach by way of the mouth, oh my I presume. Goodness. And it does one of two things. It placement of this instrument may arouse the person who isn't dead.
Okay. We know it's going all the way into the stomach.
Right. Yeah. And it measures the body's core temperature to see if death has actually occurred. Now, this was not a crazy idea, since taking the temperature of a corpse is still used in modern science to help determine time of death, but is way more complex process than simply taking the temperature. Okay, the ICARD test in 1905. This is a harmless injection of fluorescein injected into the arm vein. If there's any circulation whatsoever, the entire skin turns yellowish green.
Wow.
All right. Cutting a vein to see if the blood was still circulating or had coagulated.
Let's hope it's not a major vein.
I know, right? The following suggestions were made by physicians who were competing for a prize in 1846 from the Academy of Sciences in Paris for the best work on the signs of death and the means of preventing premature burials. They actually had a contest, because this was such a major thing.
that's why we have such a long list.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, we're not even close.
Yeah.
Okay. Introducing leeches near the anus. Mm,
the poor rectum.
I mean, of all the things. Okay, wait. So of all the. Right.
The poor rectum. The
rectum. Yeah. For it to be an exit, it really takes a lot of abuse. I mean, I don't even know that this would wake me up, you know, like, I want you to do some, I want you to take more drastic measures than just putting a leech near my rectum.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Okay. Application of specially designed pinchers to the nipples. This sounds like just everyday sex for some people. Leeches near the anus, pinchers on the nipples. Oh. Okay. Piercing the heart with a long needle with a flag at the end of it. If the heart was still beating, the flag would wave. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Eugene Bouchut invented a stethoscope to listen for a heartbeat. If no heartbeat could be heard for 2 minutes, the person was dead and could be safely buried. He won the competition with this idea and the invention. Later, this concept of death after no heartbeat for 2 minutes changed with the invention of the EEG to detect brain activity, and then again, the invention of the defibrillator. All right, moving on. Rubbing prickly bushes over the body. Sticking corpse's finger and ear to hear a pulse. That seems weird.
Yeah, it does. Right? Yeah.
No. Manipulating the tongue. Galvanism, which is stimulating the muscles with pulses of electrical current, which is what they did to that medical student.
Right.
Shocking the body with pain. Those were the death tests. I think there were maybe some more, but they weren't as interesting. And so for the sake of time, I just left them out.
I just have to touch on the fact that this entire list that we just went through.
Yeah.
Although they make sense in a very morbid way.
Yeah.
Some of these people that we've read about thus far couldn't feel any of that.
I know.
Or they could, but they couldn't respond
to it. Yes, exactly. Yes. I mean, just thank God we didn't live in the Victorian era.
Right. Oh. Think on the fact that even the catalepsy, it affected your sensitivity to some things.
So yeah.
They could be hammering away or putting up everything up your fingernails and up your rectum. And
in any orifice or not orifices.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the whole time you know, hey, well, something's up. Like, why can't I open my eyes?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I know. It's crazy. Mm. Next, we're going to talk about precautions to prevent being buried alive, which feels similar to the death test. So some of these I had to like go back through both lists and try to figure out, should this really be a death test or should be a precaution to being buried alive? But anyway, so if it kind of feels like it should be a death test, maybe I forgot to cut and paste it. But anyway, the first thing is the most common thing, and that was a several day waiting period. Yes. Okay, so the body is left in a casket for days or weeks before burial. Some historians believe this is why wakes are held in many cultures. Yes. To see if the person will wake up.
Yes.
Here's one of the quirkiest stories I read while doing this research. The following excerpt is from the book called Buried Alive by Jan Bondison. And Eric is going to read us a story.
Miss Hannah Beswick, a wealthy spinster living in Manchester, was even more frightened of being prematurely buried after her brother had narrowly escaped this dire fate. She left 20,000 guineas to her family physician, Dr. Charles White, on the condition that she never be buried alive, that her body instead be embalmed and kept in the doctor's collection of anatomical preparations. Every day for several years, the doctor and two reliable witnesses were to lift the veil and survey the countenance of this resident patient for any signs of life. Later, the doctor put Miss Beswick's mummy inside an old clock case and opened the clock face once a year to see how his favorite patient was doing. Thanks to her eccentric will, the immortal Miss Beswick became quite a celebrity. As a child, Thomas De Quincey was taken to Dr. White's house in Lower King Street, Manchester, to see the mummy inside the old grandfather clock. The doctor loyally fulfilled his side of the deal to the end. After his death in 1813, Miss Beswick's mummy was taken to the Manchester Natural History Museum, where it was publicly shown in the entrance hall. Finally, it was decently interred in 1868.
Yep. It reminds me of those people that have their heads frozen or whatever.
You make sure I am gone all the way.
Yeah.
He kept his end of the bargain.
He did. The next precaution to prevent being buried alive, washing a corpse before burial, such as was effective in reviving apparently dead persons during the smallpox epidemic or with certain religions and or cultures. Again, we have story time with Eric from the Lazarus Syndrome.
It is interesting to note in this regard that the Arabs always wash their dead in a brisk, thorough manner, which suggests that they have long known the restorative effects that such vigorous treatment can have on those who are not really dead. The adopted Bedouin H.R.P. Dickinson gives the vivid account of the work of the body washer or ghassal in the classic work of The Arab in the Desert. The body washer places the nude body on a large wooden table and pours water over it in quantities. Then, with a gauntlet coarse wool, which he puts on his hands, he scrubs the corpse all over with soap and water, sousing it over and over again with copious douches of water. After this procedure, he dries the body well and dresses it up in its new white cotton shroud, or perhaps assists members of the family to do this. Yet, as burial happens next, and always within 24 hours of death, in accordance to the teachings of the Quran, washing has to be an immediate effect to prevent someone still alive from being buried. Such a surprising restoration happened in 1973 during the washing of 53-year-old Murat Muletia, who had collapsed and apparently died while suffering an epileptic seizure. His best friend, Iman Abdullah, happily took him on the ritual of washing him. Yet Abdullah was so shocked when Muletia groaned and sat up after he had thrown a bucket of cold water over him that he had a heart attack and fell down dead again. Indeed, their roles were now strangely reversed. For the next day, Abdullah was not only immured in the coffin of intended for Muletia, but the latter helped to bury him.
Okay. In 1792, Dr. James Curry suggested that resuscitative attempts should be carried out for several hours to ensure the person could not be revived. Some people were buried with accessories such as crowbars or shovels for use in digging themselves out. Okay, come on. You're buried underground 6 feet. You really think a crowbar or a shovel you're going to get yourself out? I mean, this doesn't make any logical sense to me.
But it says so much about where society was in that point in time.
Yeah. Fear. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Vertical pipes extending from the ground into the casket for communicating with the outside world. Oy. Bells, but sometimes the decomposing corpse would shift and accidentally ring the bell.
This is one of the things that when you told me we were doing this episode, I immediately thought of.
Servants paid to sit by the grave for several days, listening for the deceased to cry for help. Coffins with special nails that punctured vials that emitted poisonous gas.
Now that one. Let's think on that one.
Yeah.
Hey.
You're suicidal in your coffin.
Yeah. Because let's admit, let's own it. You're going to have a slow, painful, agonizing death.
Yeah.
So here you go.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Just give me a little arsenic pill. Some people wanted to be buried with guns, knives, or poisons so that they could kill themselves if they woke up buried alive. Cremation was another way. You think that cremation is another way that you could prevent being buried alive. But, okay, the Greeks and Romans knew that the signs of death weren't error-proof. So they took great care to prepare the body to ensure no one was cremated or buried alive. Here we go again. First, the corpse would be washed and scrubbed using warm water, believing that if the person were alive, this would help revive them. Second, the corpse was perfumed and wrapped in white robes. Next, a group of women would gather around the corpse, singing, lamenting, and even howling loudly as to rouse the person, should he not really be dead. This singing ritual sometimes went on for up to 8 days before placing the corpse on a funeral pyre or into the grave on the ninth day. But amazingly, there's a story from Pliny the Elder who lived in 23 to 79 CE or 1st century AD.
So yeah, the story from Pliny the Elder. Pliny notes that Acilius, Aviola, like Celius Tubero, was certified dead by his doctors and had gone through the standard funeral preparations described above. He did not revive until after the pyre had been lit and the flames had actually begun to burn him, by which time most of the mourners had left the scene. Only one man, his old schoolmaster, remained, but despite his frantic efforts, he was unable to stop his screaming former pupil from burning to death.
I know, isn't that sad? That's so sad.
How traumatizing.
I know. Ugh. God, makes me never want to attend a funeral again. You'll be like poking the body. You okay in there? Yeah. Anybody home?
We say we're...
Blink if you have catalepsy.
Don't move if you think you have catalepsy. Oh, Lord, forgive me.
Okay. Great Britain formed the Cremation Society in 1874. This was in order to prevent or ensure no one was buried alive, to curb the activities of resurrectionists who were stealing freshly buried corpses to sell to medical schools for anatomical dissections. And then the Cremation Society was also formed because they were running out of land to bury the dead. And probably for other reasons, too. Mm. A similar event to the one about Pliny the Elder and the student on the pyre. Yeah. A similar event happened as recently as 1989 in India, as some Hindus still do these outdoor funeral pyre cremations. Although in this case, 100-year-old... feisty grandma sat up and impatiently demanded to be taken home. And fortunately, she did survive.
100 years
old. Yes, and she basically sat up and was like, what is happening? I want to go home. Oh, I bet you want to go home.
You know, it boggles my mind to think, you know, we have all of these traditions, case in point, this the pyre and the burning. But did they have buckets of water on standby in case?
I doubt it.
Yeah, like...
Embalming, current day. Almost everyone buried in the United States today will be embalmed. But amazingly, there's a story from 1830 in Rome where a cardinal was believed dead, and when the embalmer cut him open, he could still see the heartbeat. The cardinal woke up and pushed away his scalpel, but later died from the chest incision. That's a very famous story, actually. Okay, another way to prevent being buried alive, autopsy. Decapitation. Stethoscopes. Again, the first one was invented in 1819, and it was used for determining death, not for saving lives. Tobacco smoke enemas, which we talked about with our fumigation episode. Okay. Gases. Okay, this is a crazy one. This is like spy stuff. Gases released by a corpse to reveal invisible ink. By using acetate of lead to create an ink, the phrase, "I am really dead," was written on a piece of paper. The paper was then placed under the corpse's nose. The body's release of sulfur dioxide, the consequence of putrefaction, would activate the ink. If "I am already dead" appeared on the paper, the corpse was officially decided dead. Although, again, we have all these caveats, although false positives reportedly occurred, as certain problems like tooth decay and tonsillitis can also lead to the emission of sulfur dioxide.
Can you imagine the people that came up with this?
No.
Thinking, I am so brilliant. I came up with this method.
This must have been one of those competitions. Sounds like a competition.
Yeah.
Okay, this next thing that I'm going to talk about was so fascinating to me. They are called waiting mortuaries. Ooh. Corpses were watched for an extended period of time to be sure apparent death wasn't a reversible condition. This seems to make the most sense, okay? Mm-hmm. Just don't bury the person until they start to decompose. It's a simple, I mean, it's very simple to me. It seems very common sense, simple thing.
You would think with all the methods they came up with to check that this would just be the simplest one.
Yeah. Like, just wait. Mm-hmm. Like, why are we in such a hurry? Mm-hmm. This began in Germany in 1791. A nurse or attendant would stay with an entire room of dead people, watching for signs of decomposition. Reportedly, nurses didn't really like this assignment, and they tried, to no avail, to mask the odors with fresh flowers. In fact, since ancient times, flowers have been used to cover up unpleasant odors of decomposition and in later years to mask the smell of embalming fluid. Of course, they are also used for sentimental reasons, but that's why we send flowers to a funeral home when someone dies. Mm-hmm. That's where it started. Mm-hmm. In 1795, a different type of waiting mortuary was built in Berlin, which relied less on the vigilant eye of an attendant and more on his or her sense of hearing. They tied strings to the fingers of the corpses, which were connected to a large bell.
Wow.
And actually, as the years went on, newer waiting mortuaries became fancier and fancier, equipped with the following: central heat for use in the winter, okay, well-aired for stench in the summer, resuscitation room equipped with surgical instruments and complete pharmacy.
Mm-hmm. Good for them.
Mm-hmm. Germans had it going on. Mm-hmm. A resident doctor who made rounds every day, a kitchen, boiler room, bathroom, and communal bedroom for the several watchmen who were employed and lived in the mortuary. Their instruction manual outlined the following restrictions and duties: no smoking, no cursing, no drinking alcohol, no visitors. They had to work in shifts. They must receive written permission from the director if they wanted to go out of the mortuary, even if only for 20 minutes. Because remember, they were looking for to see signs of life.
Right.
Just before going to bed, each watchman must set the large clock just outside the communal bedroom so that the director could keep tabs on how long he'd slept and punish those who tried to sleep in. It's kind of like the first, you know, time clock.
Micromanaging.
Right. Yes. Yes, they were.
Although I get it. I understand the list. But what's up with no cursing?
Maybe because it was like...
You don't want
hallowed
to offend.
Ground.
Right. Okay.
You know.
Got it. Yeah. Because everything else makes sense to make sure you are alert.
Yeah. I think they just wanted to have it be like a peaceful, what do I want to say? Why can't I think of words tonight? Sacred. Like, yeah. Why can't I think of words tonight? Other duties that these watchmen had. Mm-hmm. Repeated cleaning of the corpse's bed and surroundings in a vain attempt to diminish the stench. And, of course, they were supposed to supervise the corpses.
Got it.
At one time, these waiting mortuaries had become so fancy that they were open to visitors like a museum. In fact, there's a great article on atlasobscura.com titled "Death as Entertainment at the Paris Morgue," which describes how the morgue was designed for onlookers and the huge crowds it attracted.
Wow.
So I want to show you a picture in this book called Buried Alive and just get your thoughts.
Okay.
Because this is a picture of the outside of one of these waiting mortuaries. I want you to describe for our listeners what that looks like.
It looks like a huge mansion. It looks fancy.
Doesn't it look like the Library of Congress or
it
something?
Does,
like
yes.
It looks so regal and I mean, it does. It does not look like a death house.
Not at all. It looks like very nice architecture that is very fancy.
And stately.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. The exterior of the Munich Leichenhaus in the 1890s.
I'm telling you, those Germans had it going on. Mm-hmm. Flip to the next page.
Well, yeah.
That's the inside. That's the inside of the mortuary.
Looks very lush with plant life. The flowers that were being spoken to earlier. Now, these pictures are black and white, but you can definitely see that it like you just said, it's not just flowers. It's actual plants.
It's like a jungle.
Yeah.
I mean, when they say they tried to mask the smell,
I'm sure there's herbs.
Yeah. I mean, eucalyptus.
Yes.
Which I love the smell of.
Mm-hmm. Rosemary.
Yeah.
All sorts of.
Yeah.
Plants.
I bet you these watchmen that worked there, they probably like, I don't ever want to smell another whatever flower again in my life.
Well, they probably appreciated those smells a lot more than we maybe realize. Yeah,
it's like putting perfume on a pig though. Well, I mean, you know. Yeah, yeah, you're just mixing smells, really. You're not masking it. They needed some poopery.
Right.
Poopery spray. All right. Due to the high operating costs and several other reasons, these fell out of fashion by the late 18th. No. These fell out of fashion by the late 19th century. And by the way, there are no reports of any person waking up in one of these. Mm. So everybody that went there that they thought was dead. Was dead, apparently. Mm-hmm. Was apparently dead. Was apparently actually dead. Right. So, all right, moving on. Safety coffins or life signaling coffins. Now, again, we could, and by the way, we could have had a whole episode on these waiting mortuaries. Oh my God. It was just, to me, this was probably one of the most interesting parts of doing this research, was researching the information on that. It's just so fascinating. And that article that I referred to on Atlas Obscura about the Paris morgue, I mean, that was like a circus scene. They had people, like vendors that would sell fruit and snacks and, you know, it was like an event. People would come to Paris on vacation or whatever, and they would go visit the morgue. It was a destination. Wow. Yes.
Yeah.
It was. And also people were just fascinated with the macabre of like, oh, we get to go see a dead person. And apparently they would also read the paper every day. And it, like, if there was some odd death of a person in the, what do you call those? The
obituaries?
Yes.
Yes.
If there was some interesting story in the obituaries, then they would really go down there.
Yeah.
And like, it was such a mob scene sometimes that they couldn't, even move.
You also have to think on the clout that you would have to be able to say, I was there when they woke up.
Well, no, I don't think I don't think it was for that reason. They went just to see the dead bodies.
Right. So like you said,
that sounds like something I would do because, you know, I love macabre stuff. I know when I say that people think, I know inside people are going, I don't know about her. Yeah. I'm not weird. I'm just fascinated.
Yeah.
Like I'm so fascinated by it. All right. Safety coffins or life signaling coffins. There's no historical evidence that a person was ever buried alive in a safety coffin. Okay. The first recorded safety coffin was in 1792. And Eric is going to read us another story from the book called Buried Alive.
The earliest example of an attempt to construct such a coffin involves none less than Duke Ferdinand of Brunswick, the ruler of one of the German states. Here we go with Germany. The Duke had read about the horrors of premature burial, and in good time before his death in 1792, he ordered some skilled carpenters to construct a special coffin. It had a window that let the light in, an air hole to prevent suffocation, and a lid with a lock and key mechanism instead of being nailed down. The Duke had a pair of keys put in a special pocket in the shroud, one for the coffin lid and the other for the vault door. But we're talking about being 6 feet underground.
No, he was buried in a vault, like a mausoleum.
Okay.
So those were like above ground, like in a stone.
Got it.
But what about the poor souls that were buried underground? What about them?
Exactly. Yeah.
So fear of being buried alive was so prevalent during the mid to late 1800s. Germany alone had more than 30 patents for safety coffin designs. There were many, many suggestions, such as drop a rope through a hollow tube from the coffin to the above ground, connected to a church bell, so that if the person wakes up, he or she can alert the people. Okay, I didn't say these were good suggestions.
Yeah.
a hollow tube from the coffin to the above ground. Each day, the local parson walks the churchyard checking for the smell of putrefaction. Mm. Once the smell has advanced sufficiently, the tube is withdrawn. If there is a lack of putrid odor after several days, the coffin should be disinterred for inspection by a doctor. If the parson hears the crying from the corpse, he uses the trumpet to alarm the town and disinterment is performed immediately. In 1822, Dr. Adolf Gustmuth demonstrated his safety coffin by having himself buried alive. A long tube which, upon triggering a mechanism by the person inside the coffin, would admit air and light. Additionally, a second tube could be passed inside it to administer food and water while the coffin was being exhumed. For the several hours he was there, he enjoyed some soup, sausage, and beer, all sent to him through the coffin's feeding tube.
Wow.
God, these people. People. Mm-mm. August 25th, 1868, called Improved Burial Case. Many special features including an air inlet, a ladder.
A ladder. Yeah.
Like, don't you need to dig your way out of there before you right. get a ladder?
How about a shovel?
Yeah. Yeah. Which, again, you know. Okay. And a bell. The patent explains, if he's too weak to ascend the ladder, he can ring the bell, giving the desired alarm for help, and thus save himself from premature death by being buried alive.
Bless their hearts.
I know. This was not a well thought out plan.
Mm-hmm.
Some variations of safety coffins are available today, which include the following. Okay, brace yourself. Emergency alarm. A two-way microphone and speakers.
Right, right.
A flashlight. An oxygen tank. A heart monitor. And a defibrillator. Like, are you going to do that to yourself? Are right. you going to put the pads on and shock yourself? I mean, come on.
Just think about this. Oh, it's 2021. We have smartphones. Oh, look, your recently deceased mother is sending you an SMS. By the way, yeah,
on our two-way radio. Oh my God. Okay. And hopefully several square feet of empty space in which an undead person can move around and use the oxygen tank, heart monitor, and defibrillator.
It's going to be a big casket.
Yeah. So I feel like I should give a special thanks to the author Rodney Davies for his book, The Lazarus Syndrome, which I referenced and read from numerous times today. Also, seeing that others writing whole books on the topic makes me feel less weird for being so fascinated by such macabre subjects. But Eric, I want to ask you before we end. If you, like, of all the stress and anxiety that it would provoke if you woke up buried alive,
mm-hmm.
what would be the thing that would make you the craziest about being buried alive? Because I was reading, you know, like, would it be the darkness or the quietness or the stillness or the aloneness or the claustrophobia or the fact that you're hungry or the fact that you need to pee or poo?
you said it, the very first thing, the darkness.
Okay.
I mean, yes, especially being buried 6 feet underground, it has to be pitch black. It is pitch black. That is the most horrifying thing for me.
Yeah.
That and the fact that you don't have the ability to determine how much space you have.
Yeah.
Your dimensions, where, like, your space. That is scary.
Yeah. I think so. There's two things that would really get me.
Yeah.
Number one, like, the thought, like, none of this has ever crossed my mind. But then when I was reading about this and they were like, you know, what if you have to pee or poo? I was like, oh, that's a good point. I would probably need to pee. Because, you know, I've said this many times on many episodes that, you know, as I get older, I have urinary frequency and urgency or whatever. And I just feel like, you know, I go to the bathroom and as soon as I'm finished, I could go to the bathroom again. Like, I just always feel like I need to pee.
Right.
And it's a terrible feeling. Like, I actually, it is really terrible because you never feel empty or whatever. But anyway, like, that would be a thing that would drive me crazy.
But let me ask you.
But I guess I just have to pee on myself.
I was going to say,
but I wouldn't want to pee on myself. Right. Because, you know, like, I mean, I guess if you're, I don't know. It doesn't make any sense that that's something that I would think about and would bother me, but it would bother me.
You know what else? Insects.
Oh, I didn't even. Oh my God. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
But the other thing that would bother me is the claustrophobia.
Right.
I cannot tolerate where I feel like I can't move.
Yeah.
Yeah. It would be. It would be hella freakish.
Yeah. That, and also the stories that I have always heard about the scratching of the coffins.
Yeah.
That too is.
Yeah.
Because you tell yourself, I wouldn't do that because I would be rational enough to know it's not going to get me anywhere.
Yeah. But I don't think you have the capability of being rational at that point.
Exactly.
I know I read there were so many stories. I read stories where people ate their own fingers. They ate their own fingers. Yeah. I don't know if out of madness or out of hunger.
Yeah.
But I mean.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I think just thinking on it now, I think I would, in my madness, I think I would try to.
I would just hope that I would go so crazy I would have a heart attack.
That would be the best case scenario. Yeah. But if I was lingering and then there's no sense of time.
Right. I know.
Yeah, there's no sense of time.
And also like the boredom. because I just FOMO, talk about FOMO. I mean, because like every night, because I live alone.
Yeah.
Hence, I sleep alone.
Yeah.
But like every night I go to sleep listening to a podcast or an audiobook. Usually something that I've either listened to before or I don't really care about the content necessarily because I just want it to kind of rock me off to sleep. Mm-hmm. But when I'm sleeping alone, I have to have that. And if I were just laying in a coffin and I knew there was nowhere to go, there's nothing to do.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd be like, oh, I wish I had my earphones. I have a story.
If that's really what's coming to your mind at that point in time, you've gone crazy from the 21st century.
Yeah, I just want to go on record of saying that, you know, there are several things that I want done with my body. So yeah. I want it to be donated to medical science if they would have me. So right. Like a medical school for autopsy or for medical students to learn, you know, anatomy or whatever. Like that's the first way that I want to use my body. Yeah. Well, no, the first way is to donate my organs to somebody so that they can prolong their life or enhance their life.
Right.
And if I can't be an organ donor, then to medical science. And if I can't be that, then cremate me. I do not want to be buried in the ground because I think it's ridiculous that we're spending all this land to bury people and whatever, and just cremate me. And it's cheaper. I do not want people to use my life insurance money to bury me and have a funeral. You don't even need to have a funeral. Just cremate me and have a party and go out to dinner and be done with it.
Amen.
So, mm-hmm. All right. Well, thanks again. And thank you everyone for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and I'm sure Eric will be back again.
Of course.
Hopefully.
Yes, gladly.
Tune in next week. It may just be Mindy and I talking about the resurrectionists.
Dun, dun, dun.
Thank you, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.